Oh, it's great to have your company. You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. My name is Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Well, we are in the ninth month of the Islamic calendar. That's Ramadan. Now, many of you will know that the observance of Ramadan is one of the five pillars of Islam. So while we're going on this, we thought it'd be a good time to get Richard Schumach into the studio. Richard works here with us at the Centre for Public Christianity. He's recently completed a PhD in Islamic studies. It's not an everyday thing for a committed Christian to undertake. And he has released a book which is titled The Wisdom of Islam and the Foolishness of Christianity. This is a provocative title to an excellent book. And we often hear people say that the big world faiths are more or less similar. But is this true? And today we're going to be talking about the differences between Islam and Christianity. Richard Schumach, as I mentioned, is here to help us do that. Thanks for coming in, Richard.
Hi, mate. Good to be here.
Now, first of all, for those of us who don't have much knowledge of Islam, tell us about Ramadan. What's going on there?
Sure. Ramadan, as you said, Ramadan is called one of the pillars of Islam. It's one of their five core practices. And what Ramadan is it's a month where Muslims dedicate it. It's a sacred or holy month set apart for prayer and for fasting. It's a special month for God. They eat and they drink and they party at the times when they're not fasting as well.
That's in the non-daylight hours, right?
Right. They fast in the daytime. When the sun's up, they're fasting. When the sun's down, they're rejoicing and feasting.
Now, I did mention that we're going to focus on the differences between Islam and Christianity. But first of all, what do Muslims and Christians have in common? They have things in common, don't they?
Christianity and Islam have many things in common, and Muslims are very clear that they believe that Islam stands in the tradition of Judaism and Christianity. And so fundamentally they believe in God and they believe in prophecy and they believe in a God who speaks to them and calls them to live a life of faith and obedience, a God who judges, a God who blesses. Many, many of those big picture theistic beliefs are very similar.
Richard, the title of the book, again, is The Wisdom of Islam and the Foolishness of Christianity. Obviously, you're writing as a Christian and as well as a philosopher. Why do you apply the term wise to Islam and the term foolish to your own faith?
I'm using the terms wisdom and foolish there in a similar way that the Bible describes the world's thinking to be wise and Christian thinking to be foolish. And what I mean by that is that Islam, it seems to me, is a sensible religion in human terms. It feels very religious. Its practices feel religious. Its laws feel like the sort of laws that God would give us. Whereas Christianity seems upside down. It seems counterintuitive. But in the Bible's way of thinking, if you can understand that counterintuition, if you like, if you can see things the way that the gospel sees things, then there's a deeper wisdom and a more beautiful truth.
Richard, I wonder if you could comment on the attraction of Islam for people, especially converts, because I think this is a key part of your book.
One of the key differences that I bring out between Christianity and Islam is the idea that Islam is fundamentally a religion that focuses on laws. Islam, the term Islam, means submitting oneself to God's laws. It's a very appealing thing to have a religion that has regulations and patterns and edicts for every single part of your life, and its life is very clear. The religion is very simple. It's very structured. It's very worshipful. If you go into a mosque and you see the rituals being played out, it feels like a very worshipful thing, and that appeals to a whole lot of people.
When you say simple, you don't mean simplistic.
As we were talking about before, there are the five pillars. So you say this, and you say your prayers, and you give some money, and you do Ramadan. It is, as you say, it's very clear what God requires of you in Islam.
You often hear people say that really Muslims and Christians worship the same God. They just differ on a few of the details about what he's like and what he expects us to do. Do you think that that's a helpful way to think about the two faiths? How do you respond when people make that claim?
In a general sense, I think that Christians and Muslims are talking about the same God when they speak about God with each other, when they speak about religion. So we are both talking about the God who is the creator. We are both talking about the God who is the judge and the evaluator of our lives. We're both talking about the God who speaks to us and wants to bless us and wants us to live a good life according to the way that he's set out for us. So in that general sense, we're talking about the same person. But the character of the God in the Bible and the character of the God in the Quran is very different.
And you really tease this out in your book. A very important one, I think, is this question of the human person. You talk about how some Muslims have argued that Christianity has a tragic view of humanity. What does this mean, and how do Islam and Christianity see the human condition differently?
In my book, I particularly respond to a friend of mine. His name is Shabir Akhtar. He's a Muslim philosopher from the UK. And he particularly describes Christians as having a tragic view of humanity. What he really means by this is that we're very down on humanity and we're down on the potential of people to be able to successfully live the religious life and to be able to please God by the way that we live our life. And in contrast, he'd want to say that Islam says that, no, well, you can do that. Humans can be successfully religious. They can do what's required of them by God.
Do you agree that it's a tragic view? Not fully, it's partly perhaps.
I don't think it's ultimately tragic, but I do think the world is a tragic place, and I do think that human brokenness contributes heavily to that tragedy. And I do think that by ourselves, we can't live a successful religious life. I don't think God leaves us in that hopeless situation, but I do think there's an element of tragedy to the Christian gospel, absolutely.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity, and we're talking with Richard Shumack about his book, The Wisdom of Islam and the Foolishness of Christianity.
Throughout the book, you make a contrast between Muslim and Christian ideas about the way that God interacts with people. So you contrast the Muslim framework of divine human interaction as being primarily legislative, to do with laws, with Christianity's view of a fellowship model of interaction between God and people. Can you explain a bit more of what you mean by that?
Well, fundamentally, in Islam, and when I talk about Islam here, I'm talking about traditional Sunni Islam. Shia and Sufi will have slightly different ways of thinking about this, but certainly in traditional Sunni Islam, the way that God interacts with you is he reveals his will to you. Even Muhammad didn't meet God. Muhammad received the Quran as a book from an angel and he passed it on. Here is what God requires of you. Here is his will for your life. You need to be obedient. As I said before, Islam means submission to God and submission to God's laws. Fundamentally, that's what a Muslim is. Abdullah, many of the names start with Abd and it means servant. Muslims see themselves as servant or as slaves of God who are following the laws. Now, that doesn't mean they're unwilling. They do it willingly and they think that's the way to blessing and they might love God in the process. But fundamentally, it's about submitting yourself to God's laws and not having an intimate personal relationship with him. Whereas the message of Christianity is that on the cross, Jesus opened the way for relationship to be restored. One of the key tragedies that is described by the Bible is a tragedy that we have fallen out of relationship with God and that Christ has restored that relationship and he promises that God will live with us by his Spirit intimately and personally in each of our lives.
That's a big difference. There in your 9 chapters in your book, you consider different Muslim objections to Christian belief. Now, there's 9 of them, but let's look at one absolutely vital one, the cross. Why is that such an offensive thing for a Muslim and such a crucial thing for a Christian?
The cross is offensive to Muslims mainly for 2 reasons. One is that one's from the God angle, the other from the human angle. From the God angle, it's offensive to Muslims that God would, to use a phrase, get his hands dirty, to come down and get involved in the mess of the world. God, that is unworthy of God. That is dishonouring of God. So they find that an offensive thing. But perhaps more than that, they also find that from the human perspective, every human needs to carry their own sin. They need to be responsible for all their actions by themselves. They take great offence at the idea that some other party can come in and somehow take responsibility for your actions and particularly for your sins, for your shortcomings.
It's so important to Christianity because it's the opposite of that. It tells you that God does in fact enter that mess and that he does in fact take the thing that is owing to you, right?
I think one of the key things that Muslims need to understand is that for Christians, when Christ is on the cross sorting things out, it's not some innocent third party who's just taking our sins over there. But what's happening is God himself is sorting things out on the cross for us.
That brings us to another point of contention, a big one between Muslims and Christians, which is the Trinity, the idea that God is one, but also three persons. So thinking particularly from this perspective of wisdom and foolishness, some Muslims charge that the Christian idea of a three-in-one God is just incoherent or even laughable. How important is this doctrine, and how important is that debate between the two?
The doctrine of the Trinity is foundational, is crucial for Christianity. Without the Trinity, there is no Christianity. And I get why Muslims find it ridiculous, potentially incoherent, because, hey, I can't explain how a Trinity would work. I can't explain how God can be three persons and one. But at the same time, I don't expect to be able to fully understand God or even partially understand God. And I do think it's possible to describe something coherently without being able to explain it completely. There's heaps of things in the world that I can tell you what they're like without having any real understanding of what's happening. Like my mobile phone, I haven't got a clue how it works, but I can show you it. I think it's similar with God in that I don't expect to be able to explain him, but I can describe him. And certainly throughout history, many philosophers have been able to do that in a way that is coherent. It might not be simple, but it's certainly coherent. The other thing to say in the book is that to just say that God is one in the way that Muslims talk about God as one, there's a whole range of philosophical problems with that, and not so many people are aware of that.
Richard, we live in a global environment, world faiths in our major cities and towns, and I wonder if in this discussion, focusing on the differences is the right discussion to be having. Wouldn't it be better to be looking at what we have in common?
As I wrote this book, and you're right, it's a book that focuses on differences and particularly focuses on Muslim objections to Christian belief. The goal was not to create division by pointing out these people are crazy and believe ridiculous things or are so different from us that there's no hope of being able to live together. The point of writing this book was to recognize that actually the Muslim worldview about a whole range of different things is significantly different. And if we're going to have any hope of genuinely understanding people, genuinely appreciating what it is that makes them laugh and cry, what it is about their religion that they love, what it is about their religion that they struggle with, unless we are able to do that, then we're never going to genuinely be able to communicate properly with people. That's what the book's really about, understanding other faiths in a way that lets us communicate properly about it.
Richard, it seems fair to say that not many Muslims or Christians have looked as closely at both faiths as you've had the opportunity of doing. So having thought deeply about both Islam and Christianity, why is it that you choose the Christian faith? What for you is more compelling overall about Christianity?
I've spent the best part of the last 15 or 20 years living amongst Muslims and Christians, and reading Muslim thinkers and Christian thinkers, and reading Muslim scriptures and Christian scriptures. And the thing that stands out to me above all is the grace that I see, particularly in the person of Christ, but also in his message. And the grace that I see there, the way that he treats people, the way that he calls me to treat other people, it's unique. And it's profound and it's beautiful. And I don't see that in Islam in the same way. And so that is why, for me, I choose to follow Christ.
Richard, who's this book for? Do you have to be a philosopher or a scholar to understand it?
I wrote this book with a reflective, thoughtful Christian or Muslim in mind. It's not a bedtime light read, but it's not inaccessible either.
Richard Schumach has been with us discussing his book, The Wisdom of Islam and the Foolishness of Christianity. The book is available at the CPX website or online booksellers. Great to have you in to talk about this, Richard. Thanks so much.
No worries, guys. Thanks for having me.
Next week on Life and Faith, we're going to be speaking to Nick Spencer. Nick is the author of a new book called Atheists, The Origin of the Species. It's a history of atheism. It's really relevant for today. I think you'll enjoy that. That's next time on Life and Faith. Look forward to your company then.